All right, so right now I'm joined with former news director Jeffrey Young, who's... are you in TO right now, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm in Toronto right now.
Cool. So recently there was... the Haiti Solidarity Network was here giving some talks about the situation in Haiti and some of their findings. I've heard that you also have some information on Haiti as well. So just maybe inform our listeners of what that is.
Oh, just in terms of the rebuilding effort and recovery effort, that basically there's still at least 600,000 or 700,000 people out of the initial, they claimed, million that are living in camps without any, you know, access to basic services and whatnot. And basically, in terms of rebuilding, the place is just sort of being left to its own devices, as a lot of the donor money has gone rather predictably to pay well, the salaries of people that work for the donor organizations. One report on Al Jazeera recently said that up to 1.7 of every $2 billion has actually gone to pay relief worker salaries at home country levels rather than building schools and houses and infrastructure as needed in Haiti.
Yeah, now, when you were in Haiti and you know, when you came back, you talked about this as far as the relief effort and how insular it really was, how they would just kind of stay in their camps if they even had camps set up. Could you talk a bit about that as well?
Yeah, and there's still a lot of camping going on.
Mm-hmm.
As it exists there now. I haven't been there in the past year. I'm scheduled to go in about 4 to 6 weeks again. I'll be back down there. But I can't imagine anything's changed. The MINUSTA, the UN mission for the stabilization of Haiti, are still, I guess, what you would call the national police and military sort of all rolled into one. And there's been no strong talk of that changing in the foreseeable future.
Right now, so maybe talking more about this structural problem within these aid agencies. I mean, where does this begin, really? Like, where do you lay the blame here? Like, is it just the people who are run, like at the very top of this, who are kind of complacent in how the...
It's a whole organizational and industry-based problem, really. I guess one place could hypothetically start is at the university level, where you'll take something like, for example, the University of Winnipeg International Development School. Will be graduating, let's say, 30, 50, 100 people a year. And all those people will need to work to get more, you know, to pay their mortgages, to raise their families and stuff like that. And they'll probably do so getting a job for a large NGO, which is going to pay them, not quite banker bonuses, but, you know, certainly a good solid middle class. The problem is that a good solid middle class income in Canada is an awful lot more than that in the subject countries. So the money that is going to pay these foreign white folks, I guess you could say, or foreign folks from the more developed countries, can really do a lot better down there. And the argument being made with the current model is basically that one recently graduated BA student is worth more than what it would take to hire. Well, given Haitian, for example, you could probably hire 20 to 30 Haitians for what you can hire one university-educated foreign white student. And so kind of the premise is right from the get-go that the workers there doing the development are more valuable than a number of members of the community in which they're doing the actual development work.
Wow. I mean, to me, when you say that, that screams of institutionalized racism.
Well, you see, and often you're dealing, in the case of the universities, with rather old institutions that are very set in a certain way of doing stuff. The university system as we know it in modern times is derived from a rather, I don't know what you would say, authoritarian kind of mindset. But it even comes down to some of the, for example, the religious schools and some of the religious groups that teach and practice international development. There certainly is, as there would be with any kind of missionary group, those sorts of undertones exist there, and are kind of automatically unavoidable.
Hmm. Well, I mean...
A very active kind of missionary development being, really kind of inherently racist, you know?
Right. I mean, How involved are these religious organizations in this kind of development work, though? I mean, are they one of the main spearheads of the specifically in Haiti?
It depends which ones you're talking and where. And centralization can take many different forms. With the Mennonites, there's a National Central Committee in Canada, a National Central Committee in the States. I don't know who or what oversees the communities in South America, some of whom own vast tracts of land, but they're also tracts of land so vast that they're barriers to development. But I don't know in the Haiti context who oversees that particular group of missionary workers there, for example. So it's really hard to tell in most cases what the behind it is, as well there's corporate structures put forward as relief agencies, yada yada, that will really be connected to other faith-based organizations back stateside. So it's never entirely clear who is responsible without some homework and going and looking and finding exactly who these organizations are and what they're doing there.
And that's quite amazing when you consider how willy-nilly people will give money to these sorts of causes. You know, I mean.
Yeah, and a lot of times that's just for not having better options available. People don't know where best to send the money and where the money is going to get there, because the groups that hold La Parole, the groups that hold the groups that have voice are all the bigger groups. So you'll see Red Cross doing a $400 million telethon, and they'll automatically get a huge share of the donors, just because, well, people tend to give in the same way they kind of tend to buy, which is without thinking. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a Starbucks culture sort of thing, and very much kind of holds the same kind of attitudinal approach of being somewhat, I don't know what you would say, but just kind of an act to make oneself feel better more than actually seeking any kind of real meaningful impact.
No, talking more, I mean, it's kind of interesting, you know, when you use the term industry with this, these sort of development agencies, because that word is not really used in a lot of, in the parlance of it, you know, when you're talking about it. But
it is an industry.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. and the goal is to retain its status and functionality as that. So really, it kind of by definition of having an international development industry requires a lack of development in order to perpetrate itself, in order to continue, in order to grow. You can even say in order to grow, it requires an increasing lack of development. So to have more and more people practicing more and more development and getting paid more and more for it. So it's kind of like there's a catch-22 occurring there. Do you know what I mean? There's
mm-hmm.
there's a feedback loop. That, like, let's say that all these organizations in Haiti, for example, got together and did their development and got Haiti just magically within 2 to 5 years functioning at a Canadian level, they would be putting themselves out of job, and well, their condo payments back at home, and their payments for a house in Wellesley, for example, well, the banks really don't care. Do you know what I mean? So the interests or the personal interests in many of the people involved lies more in keeping themselves in a job than putting themselves out of business, which should be the goal in international development.
Right, but I mean, even that's kind of a catch-22 of itself. If it'd be a weird goal for the business to put itself out of business, right? You know.
Well, exactly, and therein lies the problem, and I believe perhaps therein lies the answer to why. Haiti, for example, or New Orleans after Katrina did not rebuild in the way that was expected by the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
It just made no sense to do that in terms of the development practitioners or the rebuilding contractors, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Now, I just want to go back to something that you were kind of talking about. I wanted you to go a little further into at least the way you see it, the correlation between the corporate interest and the church missionary interest. Is there a tight correlation between the two? Are they working more or less together, or what's going on there?
I can't really speak to that. I'm not aware of any such direct situations going on. What I meant when I said that is more in the case that a lot of these organizations of faith will have subsidiary not-for-profit organizations that they work through.
Oh, okay.
So you see, for example, Samaritan's Purse, instead of seeing Franklin Graham and the Billy Graham family.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And so some of these not-for-profits are actually connected to religious nutters.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Now, if you're talking about a model for development, proper development, not what we're seeing now, what would that look like? How would this go about being created?
Well, I'm not really entirely sure. I spent a lot of my life thinking about this over my work in Haiti, and is this how to do it? Is what we're doing correct? Is it going to be more successful than these other models? And really, I'm going to repeat what a lot of Haitians say. I think it would be better if the white workers just stayed away completely. And if your project is not Haitian-driven and is not Haitian-determined, then maybe it shouldn't be taking part in the first place. And what is needed is a regime of northern countries in this case, taking hands-off, just basic hands-off Haiti. Let Haiti develop in a natural Haitian-determined, Haitian-driven sort of way. And chances are that development will be more sustainable than the kind of colonial undertone development that's taken place there in the past. I think if you leave them alone, they'll do just fine, thank you very much. I recently got to spend a few weeks in Iquitos, Peru, which is in the middle of the Amazon. It's the world's largest city with no road access. And there you can see local populations determining their own development in a way that wasn't possible in Haiti. And what you see is a lot more schools, a lot more infrastructure. You have a situation where despite making an average of $1 to $3 a day, everybody generally eats and everybody is generally sheltered because their development has come at their own hands as Amazonians instead of kind of being foisted on them by outside interests and stuff like that. Now, granted, the church and whatnot are there, but as agents of development, it's the people that have adapted to that particular environment to be able to make it sustain the lives of the 500,000 people that live around there. And in terms of Haiti, you know, that's a very small country. There's only 9 million people, and is rather resource-rich for the 9 million people there. They could live off the tourism built along the beaches because the whole country is pretty much beach, for example. So just returning as much control as possible and putting it in Haitian hands and kind of supporting, educating those Haitian hands so that they can best meet the outcomes that are most favorable to their communities.
Right. I mean, it's funny, too, because, I mean, that seems to make the most sense when you lay it out like that. Yet, I mean, it people would, there'd be a lot of folk who would say, well, You're crazy. That would never work, right?
Well, what is actually preposterous is a bunch of northern Canadians. I'm not going to just continue attacking Mennonites, but a bunch of northern Canadian intellectuals and researchers and studiers and quote unquote development workers thinking that they know best what is best for an island in the Caribbean, several thousand miles away, with a cultural backing in African animism and French colonialism. So really having no common experience to many of the development workers that go there whatsoever. And when those workers show up, what they tend to do is impose culture, not sort of, what would you say? I'm going to use the word bow, but it's not really the correct word. Rather than kind of bowing to the predominant culture and letting it determine the development outcomes.
Well, Jeff, I think we'll leave it there. About this 15 minutes, you gave a lot, and I thank you for that, for coming on and giving your time.
All right, thanks a lot.